Deutz in the year 1252. Hugo and his colleagues have been working here in Deutz on the other side of the Rhine from Cologne for several hours. They had been hired as siege engineers by the Archbishop of Cologne, Conrad von Hochstaden, to build several trebuchets. A trebuchet is a large slingshot, a throwing machine made of wood and ropes that can fire large, heavy stones. Have any of you ever played Kingdom Come Deliverance? In the PC game, you build one at the end of the story. Sorry for that spoiler if you haven't played it yet. Or in Age of Empires 2 as well. But I digress. Hugo and his colleagues had now finished. It had taken them several hours to assemble the several trebuchets consisting of individual parts. Now they could finally get down to business. But what was that going to be? Deutz, which was only incorporated into Cologne in 1888, was owned back then by the Archbishop and or the County of Berg at the same time. The city of Cologne on the left bank of the Rhine was of course also part of it, a part of the Archbishop's reign, but there was another dispute going on in this city. The citizens of Cologne and the Archbishop were, surprise, at loggerheads again. This time, it was all about the nitty-gritty, about money. And not about a certain amount of money, but money, the currency, in general, itself. The Cologne penny. One of the leading currencies in Northwest Europe in the Middle Ages. And there was a fierce dispute about it. So fiercely that trebuchets were erected in Deutz to shoot at Cologne. The trebuchets were ready. Their limbs looked westwards as high as two-story houses, towards Cologne. Then came the order. The counterweight was pulled upwards using ropes, winches, and above all, manpower. This lowered the throwing arm. It was fixed in a locking device when it reached its lowest point. The projectile was placed in a sling at the end of the throwing arm, and the weapon was ready to, for use. I'll put a video on the homepage that shows this weapon of destruction. Hugo personally released the locking device on one of his trebuchets. The counterweight sank directly downwards, because of gravity, pulling the throwing arm upwards with a jerk. And so was the projectile in the sling. It was an impressive spectacle. At the highest point, the sling was released and the stone flew in a high arc towards the rebellious city, ready to crush everything. Lord of the Rings, Battle of Minas Tirith sends its regards. But Holy Cologne, Sancta Colonia, was lucky in 1252, as the city's saints once again seemed to save the city from great disaster. The projectiles fired off by the trebuchets flew far and wide. Yes, that's what they were made for. But the Rhine River was so wide, after all, that they all splashed ineffectively into the water just before the banks of the city of Cologne and at most startled a few birds. Cologne was lucky. It was the climax, this shooting of Cologne with trebuchets in 1252, of this renewed conflict between the city and its ruler, the Archbishop of Cologne. Rich Cologne citizens, and the Archbishop, were fighting again. What was going on? We find out right after the intro. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past and hence can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. In the 13th century, Cologne was one of the most economically important cities in the Holy Roman Empire and the largest populated city in the Holy Roman Empire, but also a place where political power struggles, economic ambitions, and social tensions collided. I mean, you've heard that here often enough, I guess. And this time, in the year 1252, it's that time again. The whole 13th century is that, like that. The townspeople, the city people, and the city lord are at loggerheads, but what was the bone of contention? As I said in the intro, the money. With its strategic location on the Rhine, Cologne was a center of trade. The city had extensive connections to England, Scandinavia, the Netherlands, and Italy. These trade relations not only ensured prosperity, but also a strong position in the medieval economic area. The Rhine was the city's lifeline in a special way and served as an important route for the transport of goods such as fish, textiles, and wine. This economic strength of the city was closely linked to the city's own currency. Yes, Cologne had its own currency, its own euro, its own dollar, the Cologne penny. This silver coin, which we have already discussed here in the podcast in a previous episode, but I forgot in which one, was regarded as a leading currency, one of the leading currencies in northwestern Europe, and enjoyed trust among all traders. Confidence in the stability of its value played a decisive role in international trade and the city's reputation. But the situation is as follows. The merchants of Cologne, as well as the merchants who used this leading currency, naturally had no influence on how this coin was made, how it was produced. The right to mint coins was originally a royal right in the empire, but in the course of the High Middle Ages, however, kings or emperors often ceded the right to mint coins to powerful princes in the empire to get something else from them in return. This also applied to the Archbishop of Cologne. It was he, the Archbishop of Cologne, who watched over the Cologne penny as a kind of central bank. As a spiritual and secular head of the city, the Archbishop of Cologne, as well as we all know, wielded an extraordinary amount of power, a dual role that has regularly brought conflict since at least Archbishop Anno II in 1074. We have already got to know the current Archbishop of Cologne this time in the middle of the 13th century in 1252. Konrad von Hochstaden, who was elected Archbishop in 1238, was a particularly controversial figure. Well, who is not? But we mentioned a contemporary source that described the chief shepherd of Cologne, Konrad, as a vir furiosus et bellicosus. That's Latin and means a man of hot temper and warlike nature. His reign from 1238 to 1261 was characterized by ambitious political goals and intensive territorial policy. Konrad endeavored to strengthen the Archbishopric of Cologne both territorially and financially, but this often led to financial bottlenecks. He had a checkered relationship with the city. He occasionally quarreled with the citizens of Cologne, but laid the foundation stone of Cologne Cathedral in 1248, as you already know, and was soon to grant the city the so-called Stapelrecht, das Stapelrecht, but we'll deal with that another time. However, the merchants were not quite as immature and helpless as they might have imagined. A central player in the city as well in Cologne at that time was the Riecherzeche, the Brotherhood of the Rich, an organized community of Cologne's merchants and magistrates. This group had already played a key role in safeguarding the city's autonomy for some time and represented the interests of the economically wealthy citizens. Its members used their trading networks to secure political and economic advantages for the city, as was recently the case here in the German throne dispute. In doing so, they relied on royal, papal, and episcopal privileges, some of which had been granted to them more recently, and some of them were even a century or older. In other words, the Cologne citizens, the Riecherzeche, had best connections. Both sides, rich citizens on the one side and the Archbishop on the other side, were dependent on each other in Cologne, both politically and economically. The close ties between the two regularly led to tensions, though. However, and unfortunately, this is often neglected in the portrayal of Cologne's history, there were often, yes, long periods of peaceful and collaborative cooperation from which both sides benefited. The granting of the Stapelrecht, the Stapelrecht, soon would demonstrate this once again. However, the basic line of conflict familiar to us remained. While the wealthy citizens of Cologne sought greater autonomy, the Archbishop insisted on asserting his old rights. These rights include the right to mint coins, as presented here. This became particularly relevant when Konrad von Hochstaden decided to devalue the Cologne penny in order to reduce the archbishop's debt burden and to finance his territorial policy as a secular ruler. A government that turns on the money printing press to be able to spend more sounds familiar, doesn't it? This decision, this devaluation of the Cologne penny, hit Cologne's merchants hard. They not only saw their economic interests jeopardized, but also the city's reputation. The Cologne penny was indispensable for international trade, and a loss of its value would have had serious consequences. This was a trigger for the conflict in 1252, and it was to erupt. Konrad von Hochstaden, a skillful but often controversial power politician, was confronted with massive financial problems. Decades of territorial politics by his predecessors had plunged the Archbishopric of Cologne to a severe debt crisis. Konrad's financial situation worsened by its own behavior, for he too had no intention of cutting expenditure. Instead, he looked for additional income. In order to procure urgently needed capital, Konrad decided to utilize the archbishop's old right to mint coins to fill his own pockets. In doing so, he resorted to a common but risky practice at the time, the cancellation of coins. This measure meant that old, valuable coins were confiscated and replaced with new, inferior coins. So more coins were to be minted with less worthy material. The silver content of the Cologne penny was reduced from 975 to 1000 to 900 to 1000, while the copper content rose to 10%, a significant devaluation of the currency. The devaluation of the coins was met with sharp disapproval by the people of Cologne. Logically, the merchants who were dependent on the stability of the currency were particularly affected. For them, as already mentioned, the Cologne penny was more than just a means of payment. It was a symbol of the city's economic independence and success. Money, then as now, relies on trust that it is worth something. You can also see this in a new permanent exhibition at the Cologne City Museum. There you can find out more about the subject and also see examples of the Cologne penny from that time. The merchants of Cologne were not only confronted with losses in trade, but also with a loss of confidence among their international partners. It was to be feared that international partners would switch to other currencies, which would mean additional costs for Cologne's merchants and undermine the previous competitive advantage of the Cologne penny. From a completely neutral point of view, you can understand both sides. The Archbishop needs money a lot and very quickly. The Cologne merchants, on the other hand, fear for their income, for their status. Two irreconcilably opposed opinions. I don't want to use the cliché of the so-called Dark Middle Ages, antiquity, the early modern period, and even our own time often still is dark. In disputes of such great proportions, the following legal remedy was often sought back then and nowadays, and that is violence. Naturally, the merchants of Cologne will have first appealed to the archbishop to revoke the devaluation of their currency. However, Konrad von Hochstaden seems to have refused to give in to the demands of the citizens. He rigorously enforced the devaluation of the Cologne penny. The citizens reacted with open rebellion and took up arms. And they were not alone. They had organized outside help. Since at least the German throne dispute, the citizens of Cologne had been practiced in pursuing an independent foreign policy, so to speak, without the permission of the city ruler. The Counts of Jülich had long been territorial rivals of the Cologne Archbishopric in the west. Count William IV of Jülich was only too happy to form an offensive alliance with the citizens of Cologne against their own city lord, the Archbishop Konrad von Hochstaden. Gottfried Hagen, a Cologne native and chronicler of the time, describes the dramatic events of this conflict. Archbishop Konrad had warships built and besieged the city with a fleet, anchoring in the middle of the Rhine River, you know. While from Deutz, on the other side of the Cologne shoreline, he used the trebuchets, throwing machines introduced to us in the intro to break through the city walls. But Cologne's city walls held firm, let alone being hit. The support of the Richard Zeche's cooperative long-distance traders in particular contributed to the mobilization of resources and troops for the city's defense. In addition, the town had a powerful ally, as I told you, in William IV of Jülich, whose troops helped to fend off the archbishop's attack. The town, therefore, remained in the hands of the citizens, but the archbishop was not defeated either. He still had his large territory on the Rhine and Westphalia, and he was one of the most powerful princes in the empire. So, this conflict, therefore, quickly reached a stalemate in 1252. Neither the archbishop's troops nor the citizens of the city who had been called to arms were able to achieve a decisive victory against the other side. However, a long conflict was not in anyone's interest. After all, they wanted to earn money, albeit in different ways. If armed forces were not a solution and nobody was actually interested in a protracted armed conflict, why were they fighting each other at all? After weeks of intense fighting in early 1252, it became clear that neither side could achieve a decisive victory. The siege had inflicted considerable costs and losses on both the city and the archbishop's troops. Gottfried Hagen describes how the moral and economic strain pushed both sides to the limits. Although Cologne was successful in its defense, the conflict threatened the city's long-term prosperity and stability for both sides, for the citizens as well as for the archbishop. Due to the deadlocked situation, it became clear that a military solution was not possible. The tensions between the parties finally led to an interesting step. Both sides agreed to resolve the conflict peacefully through arbitration. Both parties agreed in advance that they would accept the arbitration award regardless of the outcome. This event in 1252 would therefore become known in the history of Cologne as der kleine Schied, or in English, the small arbitration. This decision was uncharted territory in many respects. It was the first documented arbitration procedure between a city and its sovereign in Germany, in which both sides endeavored to settle a dispute on equal footing through a neutral mediator and would be successful. It is remarkable that Konrad von Hochstein accepted the citizens of Cologne as equal negotiation partners. Remember how Anno II mercilessly suppressed the uprising of 1074 in the legal aftermath. Konrad, on the other hand, acted very differently almost 200 years later. He neither leveled accusations against the citizens and their military actions, nor against the alliance policy against him in the form of Count William IV of Jülich. Here, after all, his own subjects had sought out a foreign enemy of Konrad. By involving himself in arbitration proceedings on the coin issue, the archbishop put the citizens of Cologne on an equal footing, a significant gesture that created the framework for the small arbitration, der kleine Schied, as it was a confidence-building measure. That was a foundation on which both sides could build. But who was to draw up the arbitration award? How could these two irreconcilably opposed positions be satisfied? It would have to be someone who was truly neutral, someone who was respected by both parties, by the citizens, but also by the archbishop. Can you think of anyone who could be that guy in Cologne in the middle of the 13th century? We recently dedicated a separate episode to him. That's right, Albertus Magnus, Albert the Great. The Dominican priest, scholar and later saint, enjoyed a high reputation in Cologne. As a teacher at the General College in Cologne, he had established the city as a center of science and was regarded as wise and impartial. His moderate views and commitment to understanding made him an ideal conciliator. He was popular with the people of Cologne and as a clergyman, naturally, also with the archbishop. But he was not the only one chosen. The papal legate for the empire, Hugh of St. Cher, was also appointed to act on behalf of the Pope in the empire. The papal legate and Dominican cardinal brought the authority of the church to the proceedings. His role as the Pope's representative and peace mediator made him a respected figure who was accepted by both parties, the Archbishop and the citizens of Cologne. The arbitration negotiations began on 26th of March in 1252 with Albertus Magnus taking direct charge of the negotiations and using his mediation skills to persuade both sides to make concessions, as Hugh of St. Cher would not arrive in Cologne in person until mid-April. By then, Albertus Magnus was already well advanced with the drafting of the arbitration award. I don't want to play down Hugh's role, but it was probably mainly to give the whole thing more legitimacy with a papal legate. On 17th April 1252, the arbitration award of the so-called small arbitration, der kleine Schied, was announced. This moment marked the conclusion of one of the first arbitration proceedings between a city lord and his citizens in medieval Germany. Albertus Magnus, and now Hugh of St. Cher as well, as arbitrators, showed remarkable skill in formulating a compromise that was fair to both parties. They had 3 points. First, the core of the conflict was a devaluation of the Cologne penny, which the Archbishop had introduced to finance his debts. The arbitration ruling stipulated that Archbishop Konrad of Hochstaden and any of his successors were not allowed to mint new coins from now on. There were only 2 exceptions, the election of a new archbishop, or when the archbishop returned from a military campaign outside the Empire or the Alps. Both exceptions were brutal pragmatism. Many archbishops said, how can I put this best and not to insult the current archbishop? Well, back then, his predecessors in the Middle Ages, they often ingratiated themselves with the people for their election, so to speak. First in the College of Priors, then ultimately in the Cathedral Chapter, which now had the election of the bishop firmly in its hands. Once the new elected archbishop had been, well, elected, the highly indebted new incumbent needed money again after he had spent a lot of it on his own election. The same applied to the second exception. The incumbent Archbishop of Cologne was also the Arch-Chancellor of Italy. Traveling to Italy, especially on military campaigns for his emperor, was very expensive for the archbishop, so he needed money after that most of the time. So, yeah, that was a compromise, therefore, found for both sides here. In addition, it was determined that the existing coinage had to be redesigned. There was to be a clear and standardized coinage that made forgeries more difficult. For this purpose, a sample was deposited in the sacristy of Cologne Cathedral, where anyone could check whether the specifications and dimensions were adhered to. Second point of 3. In the past, the citizens of Cologne had enjoyed privileges that exempted them from paying custom duties at toll stations that were under the secular rule of the Archbishop of Cologne, like when they were sailing up the Rhine or down the Rhine, for example. The arbitration ruling confirmed this exemption from custom duties and cancelled new demands by the archbishop in introducing new custom and taxes for Cologne merchants. This decision strengthened the city's economic independence and reduced costs for merchants, which facilitated international trade. Here Albertus Magnus sided with the citizens. Point number 3. No compensation for anyone. Although both sides had suffered heavy losses, the arbitration award ruled that no compensation had to be paid to the other. This was an important step towards avoiding future disputes and focusing on reconciliation and cooperation. It was also stipulated that all hostilities incurred during the conflict, including the killing of citizens or soldiers, should be forgiven. And hey, dear people, it works. Not every conflict always had to end in the most brutal spirals of violence. An agreement was reached here. Small spoiler, of course, the small arbitration would not last forever. Just a few years later, in 1258, Albertus Magnus would once again have to mediate between the city and the archbishop, resulting in the then great arbitration. But that's another story. But yeah, it shows still that conflicts do not necessarily have to end in violence and that negotiations are possible even in a hostile atmosphere. The involvement of high-ranking mediators such as Albertus Magnus and Hugh of St. Cher helped to make the proceedings a model for future conflict resolution. The small arbitration was also master in the development of local self-government in Cologne. By being recognized by the Archbishop as equal negotiation partners, the citizens consolidated the position and laid a foundation for the city's later development, a step further into becoming a free imperial city. Albertus Magnus and Hugh of St. Cher took precautions to ensure that the arbitration award was complied with. The citizens and the Archbishop had to agree to the decision through oaths, which increased the moral and legal pressure. In addition, the arbitration award was confirmed by papal authority to guarantee its enforceability, and the abbot of Great Saint Martin was appointed as conservator to monitor compliance with the agreements. The arbitration also established a clear division of roles in Cologne. While the Archbishop retained certain sovereign rights, the influence of the citizens on the administration and economic regulations was strengthened in the city, particularly in this case with regards to customs and minting rights. Was it now all peace and happiness? Of course not. I was just saying that it wasn't that difficult for people at the time to agree on a compromise. What was missing, however, in the aftermath was a higher neutral authority, a central force that was able to monitor and enforce compliance with the small arbitration. You know, if you don't do what a judge told you to do in a court, the police will get after you, no matter where you are in your country. But that's not the case in the Middle Ages. And that's what Konrad of Hochstaden knew. He simply did not abide by it. After all, he not only ruled over Cologne, but also over a much larger area on the Rhine and in Westphalia. He therefore continued to have inferior Cologne pennies minted in all his other mints across his realm. In 1258, as already mentioned, there would be another dispute about that, but we'll deal with that another time. Hugo and his colleagues at the Trebuchets, on the other hand, had long since left Cologne, or rather Deutz, by the time the arbitration award was pronounced on 17th May of 1252. Siege engineers were always needed somewhere. What did I use as literature this time? The classic, of course, Karl Dietmar and Hugo Stehkemper's Cologne in the High Middle Ages. But above all, Dieter Strauss' contribution to a commemorative publication helped me this time in a great extent. His contribution entitled 57 Jahre kleiner Schied, or in English 750 years of the small arbitration. And it's a really well summarized, compact and complex presentation of the facts that I presented to you here in this episode. This podcast in general is largely dependent on the works already done by historians, some of whom have worked on topics for a lifetime. Without their research, this podcast would not be possible, especially not at this frequency. In the end, I just have to say thank you. Thank you to my Patreons who helped me to keep this podcast going and alive. Thanks also to those who have thrown something into the hat, a tip via PayPal. Thanks to Dirk Carsten, Johann, Christopher, Regina, Heinrich, Antje, Christian, Kerstin, Klaus, and Sylvia. Recommend me further, rate this podcast wherever it's possible, and auf Wiedersehen.